You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Earlier this month, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced that it would defer approving new licenses for the Indian Point nuclear reactor, which is located just 38 miles north of New York City, until it assesses the potential threats of the site's storage of spent fuel rods to both the environment and public safety. Joining me now for a look at what that decision means for Indian Point and how spent fuel rods there are currently being handled are Manajo Green, the environmental director of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, and Richard Webster, the power cotchet attorney for the Environmental Enforcement Project at Public Justice, public interest law firm. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Thank you, Lynn.
Clearwater joined New York State Attorney General and Riverkeeper in a joint filing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What does the filing seek to do, Richard?
Well, we actually had two filings. One is a joint filing and one is a separate filing. The joint filing seeks to require the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to carry out environmental work to show whether long-term storage of the waste on site can be environmentally acceptable. And we actually filed then a safety contention, which basically alleges that at the moment there's no work that shows that this waste can be stored safely on the site for the long term.
Manajo, you recently toured Indian Point. Can you describe how those spent fuel rods are stored?
They're stored in racks, and unfortunately, they are overcrowded in those fuel pools. They are now using what they call dense pack storage instead of open storage where there would be enough space for adequate cooling. They are almost right up against each other.
Is that because they haven't been sent off
exactly
to another place? There was a kind of a normal rotation in the past. There's no place to send them?
Yeah, it actually never occurred. After about 5 years, these fuel rods, which are very, very highly radioactive, even though they've been used, they're extremely highly radioactive, they need to be moved out of the fuel pools into some form of permanent storage. Yucca Mountain never opened. That was to be the national repository. And so they just kept putting more and more fuel in the pools.
Are you most concerned by the condition of the pools themselves or the density of the fuel rods?
Both, absolutely both. The fuel rods are far too crowded, and a way to relieve that would be to move them to on-site dry cask storage. But also, the fuel pool was so murky, you could not see what was going on. There's a thick layer of debris at the bottom of the pool, and they've only been able to visualize the top 40%. So there could be cracks or leaks or other problems with the racks themselves.
And you can't just move them.
Well, they could move them, and they actually are refusing to move them because there's cost involved. And so they are putting their profit ahead of public safety.
Richard, what other storage alternatives have been designed in the 40 years since Indian Point was constructed?
Well, the storage alternatives basically are dry cask on site, and then in theory, there's a possibility of a deep repository. But as Manna said, that was promised in 2008. It was then promised again in 2025, and then it was ultimately cancelled in 2009. Other countries are doing different kinds of deep repository storage, but we really haven't taken any hard decisions on this. And so what's happened is, by default, we end up with Yucca Mountain on the Hudson, where the waste just stays at the reactor site.
What are dry casks, and how do they work?
So dry casks are big steel and concrete casks where you can put fuel that's 5 years old or more into these casks, and they stay on the site, but in a much safer form than in the spent fuel pool. And indeed, they have some of these dry casks already at Indian Point, but the way they're planning to operate is to keep the spent fuel pool basically full and just take the overflow to dry casks.
And doesn't the nuclear industry kind of oppose them?
quite...
Well, the industry is a little ambivalent, of course. They will tell you that that these dry casks are extremely safe and will be good for the long term. But they have taken the position that they won't, that the spent fuel pools themselves are safe, so therefore there's no need to spend the money to move the fuel from the spent fuel pools to the dry casks.
Well, Matt, have the pools leaked radioactivity in the past?
Absolutely. One of our other contentions in the relicensing process is about the leaks of radioactive material into the Hudson River. Most of that leaking came from Fuel Pool 1, which has since been emptied. But as I said, they haven't even been able to adequately inspect Fuel Pool 2. And, you know, you asked about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's oversight, and it's occurred to me that they are so aligned with the industry nationally and with Entergy in this case that every time we see testimony in the relicensing case, the NRC's testimony is almost verbatim what Entergy says. You would not expect that from an oversight agency.
And this doesn't matter whether who's in the White House?
It does not at all. This is in terms of the NRC staff themselves. I think that the Atomic Safety Licensing Board that oversees the whole relicensing process has been very independent. But the NRC staff, I hate to say it, but it appears to me that this oversight agency is in bed with the industry at the expense of public health and safety.
Before we pursue this a little further, can I ask an kind of innocent question? Could they build some more storage pools? Would that ease the problem?
That's actually the solution that they pursued at Fukushima, is building storage pools. I think an Indian point, there isn't enough room to build storage pools. And I think, in general, we're agreed with the industry that the dry cask solution is preferable to more pools. I mean, Leonard, can I just tell you the risk of these pools? I just don't want people to lose the fact that if a spent fuel pool fire were to happen at one of these reactors, we could get as many as 5,600 cancer deaths and $461 billion in damages. So we're talking about a huge risk. It really is an existential risk to New York City. And what we're saying is that this risk should be reduced as much as possible.
Well, since there's been this cozy relationship, Mana says, between the NRC and the nuclear industry, why are all of the assumptions of the past being called into question now? Is it because of Fukushima
or because
of new people at the NRC?
No, it's primarily because of court action taken by New York State.
Mm-hmm.
Two things happened. One is that the Obama administration canceled Yucca Mountain. The NRC had been laboring under what I think was a delusion, which was that Yucca Mountain was a very good place to put nuclear waste and that it would be ready by 2025. When it was canceled, that delusion went away. The NRC then tried to manufacture another delusion, and they said that the repository would be ready, quote, when necessary. The court found that kind of approach, saying that you hope a repository is going to be ready, but you don't know when, is severely flawed. And therefore, the court found that the findings of confidence that this repository would be ready were not legal. And then because of that court finding, which is a D.C. Circuit finding, ultimately the NRC decided to suspend licensing.
My guests are Richard Webster, the power conscious attorney for the Environmental Enforcement Project at Public Justice, and Mana Jo Green, the environmental director of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. We're talking about the Indian Point nuclear facility, the nuclear reactor, and a recent decision by the NRC to perhaps reassess its positions. It just got a new chair, Allison McFarlane. She said that the commission needs to spend more attention to spent fuel. Do you think that's one of the reasons also that the NRC is reviewing this policy?
Well, I think actually there's some interesting currents at the NRC. One is that the Republicans on the NRC are really still annoyed that the Obama administration canceled Yucca Mountain. And two is that on more on the scientific side, which I think is where Alistair McFarlane is coming from, there are very severe questions about whether Yucca Mountain was viable, and we need to re-examine completely our strategy. So I think that those two strands align to get this kind of decision from the NRC.
And is the NRC suggesting dry cask as an approach?
Alison McFarlane has said that she wants to look at all the possible options. Dry cask storage is the best approach that we know of, but just putting these highly radioactive fuel rods into casks is better than leaving them in the pool, but they are still potentially sitting ducks, for example, a terrorist attack. There's something called hardened dry cask storage, and also the possibility of a national repository or repositories. But then you have the danger of the transportation. So we think the safest solution is what's called hardened on-site storage in dry casks that are well ventilated and that are dispersed around the site rather than crowded on pads and make a potential target.
But they would still have a very long half-life, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
They would still be very dangerous for thousands and thousands, millions of years into the future?
Well, that's right. And there's dry cask, to be clear, dry cask storage is a good short-term solution, but it isn't good for the long term. And so we really don't have a good solution for the long term yet. But what we're saying is let's take a step to make things safer, and let's be very careful before we license new reactors and create more waste that in the end we are going to figure out what to do with it, which is a problem we've had for about 50 years and we haven't yet solved it.
Well, who's ultimately responsible for making the decisions on storage? Is it the NRC? Is it Congress? Is it the White House?
Well, ultimately, it's Congress. I mean, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act dictated that Yucca Mountain would happen. And there's indeed a lot of legal dispute about whether the White House has the power to cancel it. The Department of Energy nominally has the responsibility to build the repository. The NRC has the responsibility to license it.
So right now, this is kind of a war between members of Congress. I don't know whether and the president, or Richard suggests that this is just the Republicans in Congress who are upset. Harry Reid obviously doesn't support this because he's from Nevada. I don't know
right. Whether
it's a political thing or whether you also don't want it in your backyard.
Well, I think it's very much a political thing. I mean, there were two sort of prerequisites to make Yucca Mountain happen. One was that Nevada had weak political power, and two was that Yucca Mountain was stable and was dry. It turned out that neither of those things was true, and that's one of the reasons that it was cancelled. So there's alignment between Harry Reid and the Obama administration. They have cancelled Yucca Mountain. The Republicans in Congress are unhappy about that.
But are they likely to do much about it now in a presidential election year?
No, because they don't want to tell anybody else that it would be in their backyard. So that's one of the political problems that we have, is that nobody wants to take this waste.
I also want to point out that right here in New York State, Governor Cuomo and the New York State Attorney General's office,
Eric Schneiderman.
That's right. Absolutely oppose the relicensing of Indian Point, and in part because there really is no long-term safe solution for waste storage, but there are many, many other problems.
I want to come back to that
okay. And
what we get from Indian Point, why some people of both parties might still be reluctant to see it shut down. After we take a little break, my guests are Amanda Jo Green, the environmental director of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, which is an organization dedicated to championing the health of the Hudson River, and also Richard Webster, the power catchet attorney for the Environmental Enforcement Project at Public Justice, which is a public interest law firm. We are talking about the Indian Point nuclear reactor with Manajo Green and Richard Webster. And we have a call from Steve, who has had a personal experience with the reactor. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you doing today?
Okay. So you actually worked on the construction of Indian Point?
Not the original construction, but I've worked there on and off for the last 10 years on maintenance, well, supposed maintenance jobs, and on the outages, the annual outages.
And?
Well, I just wanted to say that I've witnessed, particular accidents take place regarding the infrastructure of the plant, pipes bursting that don't get reported in the news. And the NRC has a permanent presence at the plant, but they didn't even interview, or they don't interview the parties involved, the workers that are involved. They don't want to know what's really going on, or they just turn a blind eye to it.
And do you have any sense why? I mean, when people try to talk to them, what do they say?
To the NRC?
Mm-hmm.
No workers will talk to them for fear of being fired.
Uh-huh.
Because it'll just get leaked back to the company, and the company will lay you off. Entergy.
Manna, you are nodding your head. You've heard similar stories?
I have, and even beyond what didn't make it into the media, there have been a long history of problems at Indian Point, including, as Steve mentioned, the steam boiler had a tube rupture, and Indian Point was down for 11 months, and there were no blackouts, no brownouts, no loss of power, and prices didn't go up.
That is a concern, but okay, go ahead.
There have also been clogged intake valves. There have been two transformer explosions, one of which leaked a large amount of toxic oil into the Hudson River. There have been multiple siren failures so that there could be no warning. And then on top of all that, there's no viable evacuation plan. 20 million people live within 50 miles or work within 50 miles of this plant. And if there was a problem, there would not be a way to deal with it.
Reactors 2 and 3 at Indian Point are just part of the nuclear energy generation here in New York, which ranks fourth in the nation for nuclear generation. Are the state's other nuclear power plants in such densely populated areas?
Not as densely. Indian Point is in the most densely populated area in the United States. The others are in western New York, up by the Great Lakes. But they are located in cities, and they are all located in what's called environmental justice areas.
Now, Indian Point is reported to supply as much as a quarter of New York City's energy. How would the city get the energy that it needs if Indian Point were shut down?
Well, first of all, it's not a quarter. It's a fraction of that. You can debate whether it's 5% or 25%, but Con Edison only is contracting for 560 of the 2,000 megawatts in the area itself, that is the greater New York metropolitan area, New York City and Westchester, use about 10,000 megawatts. So it's a fraction of that. Most of the peak demand has to be, 80% of that has to be generated within New York City itself primarily by the fossil fuel plants. Now, those add to air emissions and particulates and increased asthma rates and cancer rates.
And that's an argument for using nuclear energy.
Actually, it's an argument for transitioning to a green energy economy, which is long, long overdue.
Well, right now, the energy generated at Indian Point is usually the cheapest in the region, isn't it?
Another cheap source of energy is hydropower from Niagara Falls, and that provides 17% of New York's energy. And once the infrastructure is in place, fuel-free solar, wind, hydro, tidal are all fuel-free, and they create jobs, and they strengthen our economy.
But I'd like to make a point here about the price, though, because I think this is a much misunderstood point. The Entergy receives the price on the market for the electricity. So, in fact, what Indian Point primarily does is it takes money from New York State electricity ratepayers, mm-hmm. and provides a large profit to Entergy. It doesn't provide cheap electricity for the ratepayers. If Indian Point were to close, electricity prices would hardly change.
Well, Richard, on Monday, the New York Times reported that one idea that's been floated is the construction of an underground power line that would carry hydroelectric power from Quebec into New York City. But in addition to its huge cost, wouldn't that take years to construct?
Yes, I mean, that's not essential in order to close Indian Point. It's the reason that that is being floated is because prices already in the New York area for electricity are very high. And therefore, it's profitable to do all sorts of things to supply New York City.
Are there, you said green alternatives. Are we talking about windmills and solar? Does the state have enough land to devote to that?
Well, I think the first green alternative is energy efficiency. There's tremendous opportunities to use energy more efficiently. And because New York City is such a huge concentration of buildings and of energy use, there's a lot that can be done quite quickly in terms of energy efficiency, and that would be the first place to go, because not only does that, of course, not generate any pollutants, but it actually saves money and is economically profitable.
And in the last decade, over 3,000 megawatts, more than what Indian Point generates, of wind have come on board, and there's another 3,000 in the pipeline, solar, and I mentioned hydroelectric. And there's also the potential for tidal. And if we find, we establish a smart grid that can balance these loads, we can absolutely accomplish what has already happened in Germany, where they have transitioned to this renewable energy, energy efficiency, green energy economy, and have phased out nuclear power and are in the process of phasing out fossil fuel.
My guests are Manager Green, the environmental director of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, and Richard Webster, the power contract attorney for the Environmental Enforcement Project at Public Justice, a public interest law firm. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. With drought becoming a more pressing issue throughout the country, some opponents of hydrofracking have questioned whether the huge amount of water that is involved in producing that natural gas production process is feasible if water shortages persist. So that is one of the things that you're not proposing?
We're not favoring hydrofracking at all. We really are favoring a transition to a green energy economy. But I want to point out that Indian Point takes 2.5 billion gallons of Hudson River water for its once-through cooling system, and that has disastrous effects on the fish in the Hudson River. The population of fish in the Hudson River are still in decline. It's not a stable population. So one of the things that will have to happen
but
is
the clean water goes out back into the Hudson, doesn't it? It's just very hot?
Warmer, and the fish themselves are killed on smacked up against the intake screens and cooked as they go through the cooling system. So this is one of the major issues related to the relicensing of Indian Point. But the other thing in terms of heat and drought is that if the water levels drop and the water temperatures go up, there have already been power plants in the United States and around the world that have had to shut down because they don't have enough cooling water.
Now, listeners have been writing in. Al from Westchester says he heard that Congress passed a law a year ago limiting a company's liability to $100 million in the event of a nuclear meltdown. Is that true, Richard?
Well, it's not a year ago. There's an act called the Price-Anderson Act, which actually limits a company's liability. And so, you know, in our view, this spent fuel pool problem is really an example of private profit and socialized risk. What's happening is Entergy is making more profit because they're taking the cheapest route possible. And ultimately, the government will pick up the tab if there's an accident.
We have another call we have from John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Leonard, good morning. I'm going to throw a bunch of information at you, and I'd like your guys to comment. Number two, on the spent fuel dry cask storage, I want to bring up the North Anna plants 1 and 2, which are about 90 miles southwest of D.C., and we are coming up to the one-year anniversary of the earthquake in Mineral Springs, which took both of those plants offline. We were told by Dominion Resources, which is a company that also operates our Millstone reactor set up in Niantic, Connecticut, And Dominion actually said that there was a break in the electrical supply to the reactor, and that's why the reactors went offline. And in fact, after careful NRC study, we are led to believe that it was in fact the earthquake that did damage to the plants. It cracked foundations, it did piping damage inside the plants, and the North Anna Lake, which was an artificial lake designed to cool those reactors, dropped fairly precipitously in terms of its water capacity in that one event. I bring that up because the North Anna reactors were originally proposed by VEPCO, which was the Virginia Electric Power Company, which when they built them in the 1970s, in fact starting in 1970, built them right on the fault line. And the fault line was not discovered till a local mineralogist, an amateur geologist, came to the state and pointed out that the reactor had in fact been built on a fault.
Now, John, forgive me for interrupting, but how does that apply to our situation here with Indian Point?
I'll explain the connection. The connection is that the dry casks that were sitting on a giant pad outside the North Anna plant moved 4.5 inches on their bases in that earthquake. And that earthquake has been variously described as 5.8 or 6.0, depending on who you listen to. Dominion actually said it was 5.3 because they wanted to come under the seismic allowance for the design and construction of the plant. But I want to get to the fine that was paid by VEPCO. Was a $60,000 fine, which was the most the NRC could charge them for deliberately omitting 12 crucial areas. And the actual study and fine were levied between 73 and 75 when the NRC actually did their independent geological study on the plant and found that it was indeed built on a fault. Now, there are various different people that will relate this to Indian Point, because Indian Point also sits on the Palisades Fault and also has dry cast storage, also is a early-style reactor with storage on-site. Your lady friend there mentioned the density of the pools, and we could go right to Fukushima to the GE Mark I boiling water reactor, which has too much fuel concentrated, not in a checkerboard pattern in the fuel pools, but actually densely packed right next to one another. And that is also causing a huge problem for the cooling apparatus, which is, you know, jimmied together, designed to cool that reactor pool at Fukushima Building 4.
Well, let me bring Mana in here, although this is the first time, Mana, you've ever been called my lady friend.
We just met. I hope that's a good sign. Indeed, Indian Point, just to bring this back to the Indian Point conversation, is located at the intersection of the Ramapo Fault and 2008 Columbia University Lamont Dougherty Earth Institute seismologists found a second fault that runs from Stamford, Connecticut up to Peekskill, right by the plant. So we have a very similar situation where we have a nuclear power plant that has become a nuclear waste storage facility located at the intersection of two earthquake faults, 35 miles from New York City, and the NRC is considering all of this out of scope. They will not even consider these problems or look realistically at them in the relicensing process.
We also should point out there are a lot of people who live in Westchester and Rockland County and the surrounding area as well.
And can I just comment on the North Anna situation? I think it's very important that people realize that, as Mana says, the relicensing process is very narrow. And one thing that the NRC refuses to do is change the basis for the design of the plant. So in the North Anna situation, we had an earthquake that was beyond what was planned for when the plant was built.
But
we have exactly the same possibility at Indian Point. I actually think that the dry cask storage area is actually one of the areas that withstood the Fukushima quake the best. And so I don't think the dry cask area is the most vulnerable, but Indian Point has a lot of vulnerabilities to increase the seismic risk, which wasn't considered when it was built, but it's not even being considered when it's being relicensed.
Richard, the two licenses that Indian Point has don't inspire until 2014-2016. Those are the 40-year licenses that the plant got when it was built. So is there a pressing need for the NRC to make up its mind?
Well, obviously, with regard to site, with regard to these risks, they're present all the time, and so there's a pressing need to lower these risks. Relicensing is a time when we can do kind of a ground truth of what were the things that we assumed 40 years ago, are they still true?
Now, if the relicensing, if the new licenses were approved, how long would the plant continue to be in operation?
Well, the new licenses, there's an application for a 20-year license, but the industry and the NRC are already discussing the idea of what's called subsequent license renewal, which is renewing the licenses again for another 20 years after that. So we're currently talking about an 80-year plant life. And the most any plant in the world has operated so far is for 47 years. So this is really kind of, I would say, surprising. It's almost a fantasy, I think.
Now, Mana, during Governor David Pattison's administration, New York State denied Indian Point a state-issued water quality permit. Has that issue been resolved, or is the plant still operating without the permit?
No, that's still being litigated, and the New York State Attorney General and DEC and Riverkeeper have taken a very strong policy that if the plant is to be licensed at all, that Entergy would have to build some form of closed cycle cooling to protect the Hudson River.
Now, a listener asks, is there a way to make Indian Point safer? What about the alternatives like liquid fluorium fluoride? What safety measures would they require? Have you thought about that? Are there other ways of coming up with cleaner nuclear energy approaches?
Well, I mean, there are some things that the NRC has found are actually cost-justified within the NRC's analysis, which I have to say is flawed and, of course, underestimates both the risk and the consequence. But even within the flawed analysis, there are safety measures that the NRC has found are justified, but the NRC, for reasons it has failed to explain, has not ordered those safety improvements. So there are a lot of safety improvements that could be done. The problem is that the industry and the NRC have consistently underestimated the risk. They've overpromised and underdelivered.
But we're not likely to see anything like Fukushima, which was an extraordinary event, are we?
Right. I mean, we're talking about events that are unlikely but are devastating when they happen. And so that's the risk is generally thought of as the chance of it happening times the consequence. The consequence here is almost unimaginably great. The risk per year is relatively low, but, you know, it's best not to just sit around and cross your fingers and hope. It's better to take action to mitigate these risks.
There's a famous quote, and I think it's Winston Churchill who said, things seem impossible until they happen. And we really do not want to see a repeat of Fukushima on the Hudson River that would affect so many people in the tri-state area.
Thank you both so much for being on our show, Mana Jo Green, the environmental director of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, Richard Webster, the Power Kachet attorney for the Environmental Enforcement Project at Public Justice.
Thank you very much, Shannon.